people is going to be reduced to 4% by the next presidential election, the GNP will have to grow by an annual rate of...
Can she go back?
Carol could take care of them.
That's right.
Miss Daisy, we enjoyed the visit.
We sure did enjoy the visit.
We could just sit here.
I always do.
We could just sit here and watch it. You see, they're all gone now. They scared each other.
All day, we didn't have nothing to do.
Yeah.
But I got to go back yonder and make a fire. I know that old man and let it all go out.
He don't pay much attention to the fire?
No. Well, he's sitting there playing it, you see.
Yeah.
He knows anything, it's all gone.
Yeah. So you got plenty to keep you busy today.
Oh, yeah. Really.
See, now they've scared each other. They've scared each other off the place.
Uh-huh.
Now pretty soon it'll be full again.
Yeah.
Now what you do, you know, you get that suet, and they like that that tallow suet the best.
Uh-huh.
It's not stringy.
Uh-huh.
And then you get some of those, and I see that there they come back.
Uh-huh.
Now there's a little scratch. You got some potatoes or something for Miss Daisy?
Yeah, I've got a good can of vegetable soup for them, and I'll get a little sack of potatoes.
Yeah, that's what they need, potatoes. They can get some soup. I wished I had a whole big hill of potatoes banked up somewhere.
What are you going to do with a big hill of potatoes, Mr. Mom?
Well, I'd give you some every now and then.
Yeah.
And then I'd go out there and get me a mess and bake them.
Well, I enjoyed my visit. Well, my chair will be right there when I come back. The
Faye, when you go down there, if Granddaddy's not doing anything, tell him I want to see him a minute. Show him something up here.
Tape across
that's
the
tape.
The old world.
That's tape.
The continuing source of people
that's
and
tape.
Trade.
That's
and
tape.
The
I made lots of that. I used to grow it when I was on the farm.
You did?
Mm-hmm.
And
every year.
You'd grow the cane and then where would you how would you get the syrup?
Had a mill to grind it, so grind the cane and make juice and then make the suet. Cook it down to a suet.
I bet that was fun.
It was. Let that buck make it good and sour. Make your suet. Have your cane skimming. Some folks take it and make moonshine out of it. Yeah, boy. Sure did. Yes, sir.
Good morning, sir.
Just fine, Mr. Ma.
Did you know that some folks would take the cane and make moonshine out of it, Guy?
Beer.
You got to make your beer first.
Yeah.
That way we did.
Yeah, how'd you do it?
Put them in that sour.
Yeah.
Then it gets rid of us, take it up and get your pot and put it on and make your moonshine.
Yes.
Us white folks and us colored folks, we made that stuff at home.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
You know why?
Well, I don't.
Granddaddy, I never made any. But, I just hear you all talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's nice to have around, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. White folks didn't have none. You got colored folks have some. Come on, boy, I want something this morning. Cold, you know.
Yes.
Be quiet there and let them have what they want.
Yes.
Us colored folks the same way about them. Sure. Got along so good till it was pitiful.
Yes.
So country folks out there lived and have no money, but we sure had what we want to eat and drink.
Yes.
I think it's about them old days now.
Yeah.
It wasn't much money long in that time, but it was a good living.
Yeah.
I'm telling you what I know for myself.
Yeah,
long through where we was. I don't know about everywhere else over the country, but I know about where we was at.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking we had that.
Yeah. Now, when you made 7-4, you could just go ahead and put up some of this other stuff, couldn't you?
Sure.
How'd you put it up, Granddaddy?
Put it in a bell. Put your cone in there. You wanted the cone there. Put the cone there and let it sour.
Mm-hmm.
That stuff making if you can that stuff and let it off when they get it ready.
Mm-hmm. Put it in bottles.
Put in bottles you want to, or jugs you want.
Jugs, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's how you want to put it up.
Mm-hmm.
And it'd be there.
It'd be there. And you didn't have to store it anywhere. You could just stick it around out in the garden.
Sure.
Little hole.
Sure.
I've seen people do that.
I used to. Wasn't no money much long in them times. The folks sure lived pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the law never bothered you.
That's right.
I don't think the law would bother you now, you know, if you did it at home on, you know, didn't bother anybody.
I don't believe he would. He might want you to give him a taste of it, see how it is. Or he drinks it too.
Oh.
Yes.
Yeah, he likes it better than anybody else.
Yes. Well, now, who is the law in our neighborhood, Granddaddy? We don't have any law here in this neighborhood, do we?
Not as I know, though.
Don McIntosh, they don't have any law.
Not as I know, though.
They haven't got a marshal or anything, have they?
Mm-hmm. I let them go this. I quit staying up there much. Ain't now.
But we used to have a sort of marshal people around the neighborhood, didn't we?
Yeah. If there were not, I don't know nothing about it.
And I hadn't thought about that.
Well, the folks through this neighborhood, they ain't ever been so bad to have nothing like that through here. I know, though. Colored and white old got long good.
Yeah.
Needed nothing.
Yeah. How your stove, Granddaddy?
Just fine. Just fine.
You really got your money's worth that time, didn't you?
Yes, sir.
And you. It don't take much to keep it going.
Hmm. That man I bought that heater from down to Reddick. I forget his name anyway. He went $21.50 for that heater. I wouldn't gain 21.50. I told him I had to have that cut on that stove. He told me he just couldn't do it. He told me that I just couldn't pay that much for it. So I went to walking on out. He said, Ben, come back here, boy. I come back there. He said, boy, let me tell you one thing. You beating me. I said, beating you how? You know that stove was worth $21. It may be, but I'm not able to pay it. So I got him down a nickel. And every time he see me, he called me and him had a laugh over that thing, because I chewed him down a nickel. One nickel was satisfaction. All right, old fella. Yes, sir.
He nice to trade with, ain't he?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You traded there before?
Oh, yeah.
Well?
What all have you bought down there, Granddaddy?
time when I got that heater.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't bought too much stuff down there. I'd gone there sometime and buy some clothes, a few pants, a shirt, or something like that. I hadn't traded too much there.
Mm-hmm.
I traded enough for him to know it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I bought some shirts and I bought clothes down there.
Yeah. He wouldn't know me now. He done forgot me.
No, I don't guess he ever would forget you.
Well, you know what Ben was doing, or having done, when I went to get him, he was having some wood chopped for Daisy. For that stove.
Oh, really?
But that's better than a kerosene heater?
Yes, ma'am. To me, it is.
Renetta, you can't see the fire. That's the chief thing.
You can feel the heat, though, can't you?
Yeah.
Well, how can you see the fire in a stove?
I couldn't see it as it was broke or cracked somewhere.
Yeah. Now, there's a little stove here. I could open that door. And it wouldn't smoke.
Nope.
And I could see the fire. Mm. But I, you know, I don't do it.
Nope. That looks like it would be a good little stove.
It ain't. Most of the heat goes up the chimney, right, Eddie?
Yeah.
Well,
let's see. Yeah. While Granddad is sitting here, we ought to ask him something. How's business down at the down the country?
Shelves put just about was a no good season. Wasn't much money made down there this time.
Yeah.
Rain. Cold, all like that.
Oh, too much rain?
Yes, sir.
But you expect some work after Christmas?
When to get ready.
I see.
There's not anything to do down there. Not about to kill and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Might be some orange out there and somewhere to pick.
That orange.
He grows a good many onions down in that part of the country, too.
Yeah. That's a pretty hard job picking oranges.
Well, it's a job that some folks like it and love it. And I used to love it, too, but I got enough of it. I got where I wasn't able to do it.
Yeah.
I had to let her go.
Ben, did you ever do any of this following the seasons like some of them always done?
I'm doing now more than I ever did in my life.
Hmm?
I'm doing it now more than I ever did in my life.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You never been up the country there?
Never have.
Up in the fruit orchards and
apples and things
like that.
I've been for the old night in New York one time.
Oh, you have?
Mm-hmm. Picking apples.
Yeah. Isn't that a nice country?
Well, plenty of apples through there, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, you were a young fellow then?
I was much younger than I am now.
Yeah.
I could jump my natural length then.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He went from Plant City up there. We made a little money up there too while we was up there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, how's when you're following seasons like that? How's your where do you sleep and everything?
Had camps, bunks in there.
Yeah.
Nice place to sleep.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
And you met people?
Yes, ma'am.
Well, why don't more people do that, Granny?
You know the camp where we was camping at. It was a tunnel about as far from our camp. Oh, I reckon about like from here up in where George Mitchell stayed. You know the railroad down under that tunnel?
Oh.
We cut through down that mountain.
Is that right?
Yes, sir.
That's a pretty rugged country up there.
Yeah. Yeah, you could hear that train when it struck that tunnel. You wouldn't hear nothing. You may just hear it coming out on the other side.
Yeah. George Mitchell ever follow the seasons?
Not as I know, though.
That's curious, isn't it?
Man got to learn things that he didn't ever know if he interested in it. George kicked the swing of that and understand it, why he might make him some money. He get in shape for the business.
Mm-hmm.
When the season on those contractors down yard, he makes some money. Some of them have two tractors, I mean two buttons, some of them have three.
Oh, really?
Yes, sir.
Is that right?
Now, the fellow that I was working with, sometimes he'd make $200 a day. Got stuff to hold out then. And he gets paid for holding that stuff. They pay the labor good and he gets paid good. He don't bother with it.
Yeah.
But Cliff was just naturally too high. Fell out of work, but I just wouldn't pay it. Some folks would get this stuff out. He used to getting that and he'd stand out for that here. Yeah. He'd been all up the state and all for it, but then he's seen that I ring. He know the run of it.
You got a good place to live down there too, haven't you?
Oh yeah.
You've been living there, that same place, all the time?
Not all the time.
Well, now, what sort of place is that? Does other folks live there, too?
Sure.
Bunch of you?
Sure. Get me a room, just like somebody coming in, want a room, they'll come and get a room from you all. My son next to me, go around and get him a room. You don't stay together.
Well, who runs the place where you stay?
The landlady and her husband.
What's his name?
Oh, sure.
Her name.
One of them named, but the woman she named Mary. Now, please, the man named George.
But it's a comfortable place to stay.
Yes, ma'am.
That's right close to where the trucks come.
That's right.
Bus, trucks.
So, you catch a truck in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
Time to go to work. You'll be out there trying to catch the truck.
Well, now, if I wanted to write you down there, how would I write you?
Just write Fort Myers, Florida. Ben Wright. Don't care who's never. I'm rooming with you. Give it to me.
But I wouldn't know who you was rooming with. Yes, sir. That ought to that following the seasons, I guess all of them ought to do that a little bit. That's one way to see the country, ain't it?
Well,
I think a lot of people think of following the seasons is sort of a scatterbrained thing to do. They got the wrong idea of it.
Well, probably some of them have.
You've heard them.
Well.
They don't say too well of what you do, maybe, some of them.
No, they don't.
And they tell you. They figure a fella just ought to stay at home or, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Work down Macintosh or something. Like that.
No, I didn't make the money down there that I've been making this season. But glad as well with it as it was.
Yeah.
Yeah. I done pretty good last season.
Fee?
Yeah?
I want Granddad to see that little horse out
well,
there.
Well, I told him that you had
one. Where is, let me see if I can find Nick.
All right.
And they're the best.
Yeah. He wanted you to see his coat.
Well, I sure should look at it.
Yeah. And this Nick's here, and he can show it to you. And I can take you.
Laws now against selling alligator products in Florida, New York State, and New York City. But they're difficult to enforce. It's a matter of supply and demand. Some 60 years ago, the slaughter of egrets and herons was stopped by a consumer boycott of feathered fashions. That could be a solution here. It's up to you, the buyer. It's your choice. Thank you.
This is PBS, the Public Broadcasting Service. Hey, watch your step. That soil you're kicking around is pretty special. Without soil, you can't grow grass, or flowers, or trees, or food. You must keep soil where it belongs, because when soil starts to move, you get erosion. Mud in the streets, even landslides. Soil pollutes rivers and kills fish. It fills lakes and reservoirs, and that means less water for drinking, swimming, and boating. Keep precious soil where it belongs. Tie it down with sound conservation practices before it starts to move. For information on how to do it, get in touch with your local soil and water conservation district.
This is WJCT, your community television station in Jacksonville, Florida. Stay tuned now for Kenneth Clark's Civilization, next in Sight on 7.
Presentation of M.E.T.
The presentation of this series in its entirety is made possible by a grant from Xerox Corporation and its worldwide affiliates.
City of hard heads, sharp wits, light feet, graceful movement, to a city of weight, a city that is like a huge compost heap of human hopes and ambitions. A wilderness of imperial splendor, despoiled of its ornament, almost indecipherable. Only one bronze emperor, Marcus Aurelius, who was above ground in the sunshine throughout the centuries. This is part of the courtyard of the Vatican, at the end of which the architect Bramante has built a sun trap known as the Belvedere, from which the Pope could enjoy a view of the ancient city. And it's in the form of a niche. But instead of being designed to hold a life-size statue, as it would have been 50 years earlier, it is enormous. In fact, it has always been known as Il Nicchione, the monster niche. It's the outward and visible sign of a great change that overcame the civilization of the Renaissance in about the year 1500. This is no longer a world of free and active men, but a world of giants and heroes. A world of giants. This bronze pine cone, and it really is a big pine cone, came from that earlier world of giants, antiquity. It was supposed to have been the point at which the chariots turned in their races round the hippodrome. And since in that hippodrome many Christian martyrs were put to death, it was here that the Christian church elected to make its headquarters. Huge, cloudy concepts compared to the sharp focus of Florence. But in Rome, they weren't so cloudy after all, because the huge buildings of antiquity were there, very much more of them than we have today. Even after three centuries in which they were used as quarries, and in which our sense of scale has expanded, they still are surprisingly big.
In the Middle Ages, men had been crushed by this gigantic scale. They said that these buildings must have been the work of demons, or at best, they treated them simply as natural phenomena, like mountains, and built their huts in them, as who should take advantage of a ravine or sheltering escarpment. Rome was a city of cowherds and stray goats, in which nothing was built except a few fortified towers from which the ancient families carried out their pointless and interminable feuds. Literally interminable, because they're still quarreling today. But by 1500, the Romans had come to realize that these mountainous ruins had been built by men. The lively, intelligent individuals who created the Renaissance, bursting with vitality and confidence, they weren't in the mood to be crushed by antiquity. They meant to absorb it, to equal it, to master it. They were going to produce their own race of giants and heroes. The scene has changed to Rome also for political reasons. After years of exile and adversity, the sovereign pontiff has returned to his seat of temporal power. Temporal power that meant so much to the popes of the 16th century, but of course are completely abandoned today. Now the pope is solely a religious leader. In what is commonly described as the decadence of the papacy, the popes were unusually able men who used their international contacts, their great civil service, their increasing wealth in the interests of civilization. And even Sixtus IV, who was as brutal and cunning as he looks, founded the Vatican Library and made the great humanist Plotina its first prefect. And here we see for the first time the splendid head of the young cardinal who, more than any man, was destined to give the High Renaissance its heroic direction, Giuliano della Rovere. What a lion he looks compared to the donkeys of the papal secretariat. And when he became Julius II, he was able, by magnanimity and strength of will, to inspire and bully three men of genius, Bramante, Michelangelo, and Raphael. This program is about a few individuals of genius. And two of them, Michelangelo and Raphael, were, to some extent, the creation of Julius. Without him, Michelangelo would not have painted the Sistine ceiling, nor would Raphael have decorated the papal apartments. And so we should have been without two of the greatest visible expressions of spiritual power and humanist philosophy. Well, this splendidly over life-size character conceived a project so audacious, so extravagant, that to this day, the very thought of it makes me feel slightly jumpy. He decided to pull down old St. Peter's. It was one of the largest and most ancient churches in the world, certainly the most venerable, because it stood on the place where St. Peter was supposed to have been martyred. Julius decided to pull it down and put in its place something even larger and more splendid. In his thoughts for the new building, he was influenced by two Renaissance ideals. It must be based on perfect forms, the square and the circle, and it must be on a scale that surpassed even the grandiose ruins of antiquity. And he called on Bramante to provide a plan. He didn't get very far with it. You know, great movements in the arts, like revolutions, don't last for more than about 15 years. After that, the flame dies down. People prefer a cozier glow. Julius II was pope for only 10 years. St. Peter's wasn't completed till almost a century after his death. But the first step in this visible alliance between Christianity and antiquity was taken when Julius decided to pull down the old basilica and rebuild it in rivalry with the enormous remains of Roman architecture. In the 15th century, Greco-Roman sculpture had become a shining, almost inaccessible model to the more adventurous artists, and collectors had begun to compete for fine examples. The greatest prize in the papal collection was the Apollo of the Belvedere, an ideal of godlike beauty. But for some time, these discoveries didn't influence their mental picture of antiquity. As they read the ancient authors with passionate attention, they wrote to each other in Latin. But although their minds were full of antique literature, their imaginations remained entirely Gothic. When the average painter set out to depict a scene of ancient history or legend, as in this picture of the Rape of Helen, he did so in the costume of his own time, with dainty, fantastical movements which show not the slightest consciousness of the physical weight and the flowing rhythms of antiquity. Well, these are not ancient Greeks, but 15th century Florentines. And the funny thing is that the humanists, who took such trouble about the text of an author like Livy, accepted a picture like this of the death of Julius Caesar as a correct representation of the event. And as long as there was this rather comical discrepancy between the written word and the image, antiquity couldn't exert its humanizing power on the imagination. I suppose that the first occasion in which the dream of antiquity is given a more or less accurate visible form is the series of decorations representing the triumph of Caesar done for the court of Mantua by Mantegna in about 1480. A piece of romantic archaeology. Mantegna has rummaged passionately in the ruins of ancient Roman towns to find evidence for the shape of every vase or of a Roman trumpet. But he has subordinated all his antiquarian knowledge to a superb feeling for the drive and discipline of Rome. I said that the gigantic and the heroic spirit of the High Renaissance belongs to Rome, and it's true. But there was a sort of prelude in Florence. The Medici, who had been the rulers of Florence for the last 60 years, had been kicked out in 1494, and the Florentines had established a republic. They made speeches full of the noble puritanical sentiments which pre-Marxist revolutionaries used to dig up out of Plutarch and Livy, and to symbolize their convictions, they re-erected two statues by Donatello, the Lion of the Republic called the Marzocco, and Judith the Tyrant Slayer. Two figures belonging to an earlier period of Florentine liberty. And the city fathers also commissioned various works of art on heroico-patriotic themes, and one of them was a gigantic figure of David, the free, pure-hearted youth who had killed the giant of corruption. And the commission was given to an alarming young man who had just returned from Rome to his native city, Michelangelo. Only 25 years separate this marble hero from the dapper little figure which had been the last word in Medicean elegance, the David of Verrocchio, and you see there really has been a turning point in the human spirit. The Verrocchio is light, nimble, smiling, and clothed. The Michelangelo, this is the original, the one you saw on the piazza with a copy, the Michelangelo is vast, defiant, nude. It's rather the same progression that we'll see again in music between Mozart's Figaro and Beethoven's Fidelio.
What a man. Everyone who met Michelangelo recognized that he had an unequaled power of mind and skill of hand. Even as a boy, his spiritual energy terrified people.
Personally, I believe that this small figure, which he carved in Bologna when he was under 20, is a self-portrait. And it shows that he never changed, except that he grew sadder like the rest of us. It has the indignant singleness of purpose that alarms ordinary accommodating citizens. And in a way, his art never changed. This Relief of a Battle is certainly one of his earliest works, and already one sees the same expressive poses that reappear on the Sistine ceiling, even in the Last Judgment. It's inspired by a Greco-Roman relief. Antique art was always, to Michelangelo, a kind of quarry from which he dug out his ideas of form. But of course, it's still rather a rough version of antiquity. And when he went to Rome, he was able to make much more finished versions of antique sculpture, some that were actually passed off as originals. This one even achieved some of the unpleasant smoothness of a Roman copy. But when he returned to Florence, he was able to charge this worn-out style with his own vigor and potency. Seen by itself, the David's body might be some unusually taut and vivid work of antiquity. It's only when we come to the head that we're aware of a spiritual force that the ancient world had never known. I suppose that this quality, which I've called heroic, isn't a part of most people's idea of civilization. It involves a contempt for convenience and a sacrifice of all those pleasures that contribute to what we usually call civilized life. It's the enemy of happiness. And yet, we recognize that to despise material obstacles and even to defy the blind forces of fate is man's supreme achievement. And after all, we see that he's expressed this by the body no less than by the head, by this living cage of ribs, by those tense architectural muscles of the pelvis. Above all, by this huge Florentine hand, so far from the antique tradition of ideal beauty. And since, in the end, civilization depends on man extending his powers of mind and spirit to the utmost, we must reckon the appearance of Michelangelo's David as one of the great events in the history of Western man. And this brings us back to Rome and to the terrible Pope. In fact, I'm sitting in the Papal Garden in the Vatican. Julius II wasn't only ambitious for the Catholic Church, he was ambitious for Julius II. And in his new temple, he planned to erect the most grandiose tomb of any ruler since the time of Hadrian. It was a staggering example of superbia, what we call megalomania. And Michelangelo at that time wasn't without the same characteristics. I needn't go into the question of why the tomb was never built. There was a quarrel. Heroes don't easily tolerate the company of other heroes. Nor does it matter to us what the tomb is going to look like. All that matters is that some of the figures made for it survive, and they are something new to the European spirit, something that neither antiquity nor the great civilizations of India and China had ever dreamt of. As a matter of fact, the two most finished of them were derived from antiques. But Michelangelo has given them a complex inner life that was almost unknown in antiquity. And he has made them convey their emotional conflicts by the action of their bodies. They're conceived as captives, bound captives. One of them struggling to be free from what? From mortality, from the weight of his muscle-bound body, derived, as we know, from a Roman figure of a boxer, and the other sensuously resigned, half in love with easeful death. Michelangelo had in mind a Greek figure of the dying son of Niobe. These two are carved in the round, but the others, assuming they were part of the same set, are unfinished. Their bodies emerge from the marble with the kind of premonitory rumbling that one gets in the Ninth Symphony, and then sink back into it. To some extent, the rough marble is like shadow in a Rembrandt, a means of concentrating on the parts that are felt most intensely. But it also seems to imprison the figures. In fact, they're always known as the prisoners, although there's no sign of bonds or shackles. As with the finished captives, one feels that they express Michelangelo's deepest preoccupation, the struggle of the soul to free itself from matter. I'm standing in the Sistine Chapel, and above my head is one of the greatest works of man, Michelangelo's ceiling. People sometimes wonder why the Italian Renaissance didn't make more of a contribution to philosophy. The answer is that the most profound thought of the time wasn't expressed in language, but in painting, just as in the early 18th century it was expressed through music. And of this truism, the chief example is Michelangelo's ceiling. We owe it to Julius II. Ever since Michelangelo's earliest biography, the Pope has been blamed for diverting his energies from the tomb on which he'd set his heart and putting him to work on the painting of the Sistine ceiling. It was even said to be a plot devised by his enemies. Well, I think it was a stroke of inspiration. The original project of the tomb included almost 40 marble figures, over life size. How could Michelangelo ever have done it? It's true that he carved marble faster than any mason, but even with his heroic energy, the tomb would have taken him 20 years, during which time his mind was changing and developing. And the very fact that in the ceiling he decided to depict scenes, not simply to concentrate on single figures, allowed him a range of experience which would hardly have been possible in the more concentrated medium of sculpture. Look at this woman holding her child in front of her, and these piled-up men looking across the flooded landscape. And this wretched woman lying there in misery, abandoned. All these show a human side of Michelangelo, which will scarcely appear again. The ceiling also allowed him to express his thoughts about the divine plan. But were they his thoughts? You know, in most philosophical paintings of the Renaissance, the ideas were suggested by poets and theologians. But in one of Michelangelo's letters, he says that the Pope had told him to paint what he liked. So, I suppose that the subject of the ceiling was largely his own idea. And perhaps this is one of the reasons why it's so difficult to interpret. It's an extremely complex work. Viewed from the ground, there's an acute physical difficulty in concentrating long enough to relate the scenes and the individual figures to each other. Some scenes are clear. The contrast between the confident, sensual twist of Eve's body before the fall and the huddled, desperate animal after. As for the general scheme, I think at least one thing is certain. The Sistine ceiling passionately asserts the unity of man's body, mind, and spirit. You can admire the ceiling from the point of view of the body, as 19th century critics used to do, who looked first at the so-called athletes, or from the point of view of the mind, as one does when one looks at those great embodiments of intellectual energy, the prophets and sibyls. But when one looks at the sequence of stories from Genesis, I think one feels that Michelangelo was chiefly concerned with the spirit. As narrative, they begin with the creation and end with the drunkenness of Noah. But Michelangelo compels us to read them in reverse order. And indeed, they were painted in the reverse order. Over our head as we enter the chapel is the figure of Noah, where the body has taken complete possession. At the other end, over the altar, is the Almighty dividing light from darkness, in which the body is being completely transformed into a symbol of the spirit, and even the head, with its too evident human associations, has become indistinct. In between these scenes comes the central episode, the creation of man. It's one of those rare works which are both supremely great and wholly accessible, even to those who don't normally respond to works of art. Its meaning is clear and impressive at first sight, and yet the longer one knows it, the deeper it strikes. Man, with a body of unprecedented splendor, is reclining on the ground in the pose of all those river gods and wine gods of the ancient world who belonged to the earth and did not aspire to leave it. He stretches out his hand so that it almost touches the hand of God, and an electric charge seems to pass between their fingers. Out of this glorious physical specimen, God has created a human soul. Behind the Almighty, in the crook of his arm, is the figure of Eve, already in the Creator's thoughts, and already, one feels, a potential source of trouble. It's possible, I think, to interpret the whole of the Sistine ceiling as a poem on the subject of creation, that godlike gift which so much occupies the thoughts of Renaissance man. After God has brought Adam to life, come those scenes of the Almighty in the act of creation, which form a sort of crescendo. The movement accelerates from one scene to the next. First of all, God dividing the waters from the earth, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. I don't know why these words give one such a feeling of peace, but they do. And Michelangelo has conveyed it by a tranquil movement, a gesture of benediction. In the next scene, the creation of the sun and moon, he doesn't bless or evoke, but commands, as if dealing with these fiery elements required all his authority and speed. And to the left, he swishes off the scene to create the planets. Finally, we're back at the separation of light and darkness, of the rare attempts of finite man to set down an image of infinite energy. This seems to me the most convincing. One might even say the most realistic, because photographs of the formation of stellar nuclei show very much the same swirling movement. Michelangelo's power of prophetic insight gives one the feeling that he belongs to every epoch, most of all perhaps to the epoch of the great romantics, of which we are still the almost bankrupt heirs. It's the quality that distinguishes him most sharply from his brilliant rival, the second hero of this program, Raphael. Raphael was above all a man of his age. Even in his early work, still painted in the clear, self-contained style of the 15th century, he has begun to absorb and harmonize all that was being felt or thought by the finest spirits of his time. He is the supreme harmonizer. That's why he's out of favor today. One couldn't write a bestseller about Raphael. I suppose one must allow that, as works of art, Raphael's frescoes aren't all that easy to enjoy. Even in the 18th century, when Raphael stood at the summit of an established Olympus, Sir Joshua Reynolds warned young artists not to be disappointed by their first visit to the Stanze, but to go on looking and looking till finally they understood the restrained but perfectly balanced language in which he expresses his ideas. I've tried to follow his advice over the last 40 years, and I promise you, it's been worth the effort. Raphael came from Urbino, where his father was court painter. And it's reasonable to suppose that he was introduced to the papal service by his compatriot, Bramante, who was not only the architect of the new St. Peter's, but seems to have been on relatively intimate terms with Julius II. At the time, Raphael was 27. He'd only once tried his hand at mural painting. He'd shown no evidence at all that he could cope pictorially with great ideas, and yet Julius had the insight to commission this young man to decorate the library and study which was to be the center of the Pope's life, where he was to meditate on theology, decide on action. The decorations must, in some sense, project and harmonize his thoughts. No doubt Raphael had passed much of his boyhood in Urbino, in the Paris library, where paintings of poets and philosophers and theologians were placed above the shelves containing their books. And when he came to decorate what in effect was a branch of the papal library, he determined to carry the same idea further. He would not only portray the figures whose books were on the shelves below, he would relate them to each other and to the whole discipline of which they formed a part. He must have had advice from the learned, cultivated men who made up about a third of the papal curia, but that sublime company wasn't assembled by a committee. It represents human reason. It's always known as the School of Athens, and on the opposite wall is divine reason, known for some reason as the Disputa. On the subsidiary wall, the window wall, is poetic inspiration, Apollo and the Muses, known as the Parnassus.
Everything in the groups is thought out. For example, of the two central figures in the School of Athens, Plato, the idealist, is on the left, and he points upwards to divine inspiration. And beyond him to the left are the philosophers who appeal to intuition and to the emotions. We recognize Socrates, but many of the others can't be identified. We can be certain only that these noble human beings are passionately engaged in a search for truth. To the right is Aristotle, the man of good sense, holding out a moderating hand, and beside him are the representatives of rational activities, logic, grammar, and geometry. Curiously enough, Rafa has put his own portrait in this group, next to a bearded philosopher who seems to be an ideal portrait of Leonardo da Vinci, perhaps intended to represent Pythagoras. And below them is a group of beautiful young men looking over the shoulder of a bald-headed geometer, Euclid, I suppose.
He is certainly a portrait of Bramante, and it's fitting that he should be there because the noble piece of architecture in which these representatives of human reason are assembled must, I think, represent Bramante's dream of the new St. Peter's. Raphael himself was later to become an architect, and a very fine architect. But in 1510, he couldn't possibly have conceived a building like this. One of the most life-enhancing effects of space in art. It may have been designed by Bramante, but Raphael has made it his own. Like all great artists, he was a borrower. But he absorbed his borrowings more than most. One has a vague feeling that these figures are inspired by Hellenistic sculpture. I suppose that's one of the things that makes him distasteful to us. But every figure in this picture is pure Raphael, or every figure but one. This morose philosopher does not occur in the drawing, the full-size drawing for the fresco, which by a miracle has survived. We can see where he comes from, the Sistine ceiling. Michelangelo wouldn't let anyone in there while he was at work, but Bramante had the key. And one day, when Michelangelo was away, he took Raphael in with him. Who cares? The great artist takes what he needs.
Human reason is rooted to the earth, divine wisdom floats in the sky above the heads of those philosophers, theologians, and church fathers who have tried to interpret it.
Mighty Fine Rich and Ready, the first pudding in a can that tastes like it came from a pot.
You are not German.
It's 10 after 10 already. I was stupid enough to help him get together.
Fast Track Tire and Kent's Knockarounds Casuals are two more products of Uniroyal.